Smith, who will be presenting information on phosphorus limits for wastewater plants, state review of municipal noise ordinances, and possible review of noise complaints, nuisance complaints, regarding outdoor wood burning furnaces and odors by municipals rather than state officials. So I think these are issues that affect a lot of our towns. I think that the information will be very helpful. And after that, we will have someone who also will talk about pest management as related to our schools as well as our municipalities. So we're going to really get a lot of information today. And I would like to have the gentleman from DEEP, if he would introduce himself.
Okay. Hello. Thank you. So my name is Mackie McCleary. I am the Deputy Commissioner of Environmental Quality for the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. I'm excited to have this conversation today. Municipalities and our relationship with municipalities has been a very important focus for me in my few years in this role. I will focus my initial remarks on, I think, two areas, and then I've brought several of my staff here to help answer questions on some of the other areas and any other questions you folks may have on our relationship with municipalities and mandates and so on. I want to just kick it off by saying that, in general, as a piece of policy, you know, we agree that anything that even looks like an unfunded mandate is something that is difficult to make work. That doesn't stop it from happening. We understand how these things occur in the legislative process and so on. But if you think about what our role is, and in so much of what we do, we play a bridging role between the federal government and the municipalities who are on the ground, either in enforcement, permitting, or any other role. And being in that bridge role, unfunded mandates are the kind of thing that get in the way of the municipalities being able to deliver on what all of us at the various levels of policymaking need. So that said, money is not everywhere, and so sometimes you have priorities that get out in front of where the money is, and that's the kind of thing that we like to try to clean up over time. Today, I'd like to talk about two of those areas in particular. I want to talk about phosphorus, which is an important issue. I know for a lot of municipalities, where I actually think Connecticut has been, compared to many of our peers, a leader in terms of making it easier for our municipalities, but I know that that's still challenging. And then separately, I want to also talk about pest management. So this is something I know wasn't on my original thing to do, but it's something, and I think CCM will say this as well, and many of the municipalities have seen me in their municipality talking about pesticides and pest management this year. I do have a lot to say on that because I think it's kind of a shadow unfunded mandate in its current form. So with regards to phosphorus limits, as I mentioned, phosphorus is an important pollutant. If you think about how far we've come with clean water over the last 40 years, it is the result of the combined investment of the states, the municipalities, and the federal government taking out various polluting components that were making our water orange or smell terrible. Phosphorus is a pollutant that damages the ecosystems, but it also is actually quite obvious. It's the kind of it's what makes your, you may see this in a lake if you've got a lake in your community that is extraordinarily green. You have algae blooms. Those are created by nutrients like phosphorus and nitrogen, but phosphorus is one of them. Recently, DEEP has engaged in a phosphorus program wherein we have laid a groundwork of science that allows us to, on a watershed by watershed basis, on a facility-by-facility basis, set a phosphorus limit that is much more flexible in that sense than the way that EPA does their limits. So if you compare how this is done in Connecticut compared to Massachusetts, in Massachusetts, what EPA says is everyone has to reach, and the units here are not important, 0.1. And what we found when we went on a watershed-by-watershed basis is that in order to get to the outcomes we're looking for, some of our facilities can be at 0.7, which is much cheaper and can be done in some cases with just chemicals. And then some other facilities do need to be at 0.1. But understanding that the investment needs to go where the most benefit is going to be is something that has benefited a lot of towns. You don't hear about it a lot because at the end of the day, what it's meant is people have not had to spend money they would have otherwise had to spend if we hadn't done that. So it's an unrung bell. But it's a good example of how we think about our relationship with municipalities, that it is our job to do that. Just last year, there was passed a bill called First 3. Do you know the number? I don't remember the bill number right now. What was it? Part of the implementer, it was in the budget implementer. And First 3 laid out, I think, a nice conversation for municipalities. Because what it did was it changed the grant percentage in the Clean Water Fund from 30% to 50% for these phosphorus upgrades, which can be expensive if they're physical. Unfortunately, it was only for the first three. So the first three municipalities that came forward in its current form, that has left will potentially leave several municipalities in a lurch in its current form, but it's a good start. And we will continue to work with the municipalities to try to make it something that's more workable for them. So the first three has been a good start. Additionally, we've been asked through 12-155, which was a bill that was passed 2 years ago, to work with municipalities to help make our phosphorus strategy even more reflective of the needs. So kind of relook at the science, build a working team to come up with best practice technology so that municipalities don't have to do the research on their own. And we have been working with that team led by Gary Brumback, the town manager, and myself, town manager of Southington and myself, to starting last fall, and we will be working for the next year to develop a report on the three areas, technology, science, and municipal policy, I think is the other, third area. We're very excited. We've actually got a meeting in a couple of weeks. But I think that has also been very helpful for the towns in kind of dealing with what it's not an unfunded mandate because there is Clean Water Fund that goes along with it, but it's something that has a lot of science. It's difficult to explain to people, and the costs that go along with it could be things that get transferred to the cost of their municipal taxpayers at some point. So we need to arm them with the capability to both minimize that and to explain it when it's necessary. So that's kind of what I want to tell you guys about phosphorus. On pest control, the current state of policy on pest control can be characterized as complicated. Put simply, there is a K-8 ban on synthetic pesticides. That means that for any field that is used by children in the school system in K-8, they can't use synthetic pesticides. At face, that seems like a reasonable concern. You know, many people have concerns about chemicals. When implemented on the ground, it has presented a large number of challenges for municipalities. And I have spent the last 3 months doing municipal roundtables with the CEOs of the municipalities and their turf managers, as well as the superintendents of the school boards in many municipalities. I've met now with about 25 municipalities from across the state, representing a variety of viewpoints, from folks who totally agree that we should only use organic pest management to folks who completely disagree and believe that the only thing we should be able to use is synthetics, and have been collecting a set of what I think are going to be useful synthesis recommendations combined with what we've learned from some best practice laws that are similar in that were just recently passed in New York State that I think that we can work together. I'll work together with the legislature to provide some feedback on how we might be able to decrease the level of complication that exists in pest management in Connecticut today for those turf managers. And one thing that really hit home for me is that, you know, in talking to these municipal CEOs and the turf managers, these folks have direct responsibility for the health of their constituents. They care just as much as we do about health, about the long-term health of their constituents. And they, in most cases, agree that they want to not have to use synthetics where there are any concerns about it or on the fields at all. That said, the policy in its current form is very difficult for them to work when it's balanced with other challenges, whether you're talking about invasive species or grubs, field quality and intensity of use. I think there are a few very small changes we could make to the policy that would make it a lot better, easier for them to use, and still be a good balance in terms of making it unnecessary to use synthetic pesticides. And I'm very excited about those, having those conversations with you. They've been great conversations with me. You know, talking to a turf manager who has to be the guy to shut down a field when you've got you know, two teams of 7-year-olds who want to play soccer, you know, that's a tough position to be in. You know, I would prefer not to have that guy in that position. Sometimes it's just necessary when you're talking about turf management. Fields have to rest. But at the end of the day, I think we want to try to make it easier for that guy to do his job. So those are my initial remarks. I wanted to talk about those two things. Happy to start taking questions now. I'd like to bring one. So the municipal review of noise ordinances. The question here is around, and you guys can tell me if I'm wrong here in interpreting this, but my understanding is there's a concern around how municipalities may end up being asked to enforce against noise response and the costs of something like that. What I can say from the state point of view is, you know, I think it is a challenge for those municipalities. At the same time, it is almost impossible for us at the state level to deliver any kind of useful response to someone who hears a loud noise in New Milford. We're in Hartford. And so figuring out a way to work with the municipalities to give them the tools they need in order to respond to those complaints is a key important thing for us to do. Outdoor wood-burning furnaces. I think we can do that by question and answer. But it sounds like the nuisance complaints on outdoor wood-burning furnaces, I think that, again, puts quite similar to noise. You've got an issue here that is transient. And I've got my staff, for the most part, that's in Hartford. So, and many of the outdoor wood-burning furnaces are actually quite remote to Hartford. And so the challenge here is that the municipalities in the state have to figure out a way to enable the municipalities to respond to complaints like this with a useful set of tools, because we can't get there in time in Hartford to even document it in some cases. And so if you want to have an enforceable policy, you've got to have someone on the ground in the municipalities. As I mentioned in the beginning of my remarks, they're the boots on the ground. They're always going to be. And so figuring out a way to provide tools for them to deliver that service is a critical thing for us to do.
Thank you. So we're going to open it up to questions, I think.
Yes.
And I actually want to start off with a question. We asked you to talk about phosphorus, but mm-hmm. I have something that's come up recently quite a bit, and I'm getting a number of emails from constituents that are talking about throwing away their used or drugs, unused
prescription.
Drugs, basically, prescription drugs, right. Mm-hmm. And I know many municipalities are actually putting lock boxes in mm-hmm. their police station and coming up with a number of other mechanisms for doing that. But a certain amount does get into the wastewater.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything around treatment that actually addresses that?
You mean at the wastewater treatment facilities?
Right, because, I mean, as you ingest the medication, a mm-hmm. certain amount is going to go through your body and end up in the wastewater at the treatment plant.
Yep.
And so, I mean, that's nothing that you can do anything about at that.
Once it's already there.
So right,
I'm going to take the first part of that, and then I'm going to let Betsy Wingfield, who's my water planning and to talk about what's happening at the treatment facility. I just wanted to say, on the front end, before it gets there, I know that municipalities are starting to deliver some solutions. It's a real challenge because of the security that has to go with prescription drug drop-off. I've seen it done at police stations and other places like that. So, but it is a priority for us on our waste management side. We're thinking about, in the future, using a tool called extended producer responsibility, which would allow us to partner with the pharmaceutical manufacturers to try to figure out a way to deal with end of life. So that is a priority for us. It probably won't happen in the next 12 months, but it's something that we're looking at to try to solve the problem before it gets to the wastewater facility. I'll let Betsy talk about what's happening at the facilities.
So you are very right that pharmaceuticals that we take in for medicinal purposes, we don't use all of them, and some of them pass through. It depends on the specific pharmaceuticals whether or not the treatment at the plant will actually sort of hold any of it back or whether it will be discharged to the environment. It's really an area of emerging research, and it's also somewhat dependent on the design It's somewhat dependent on the design of the plant. The most promising research I've seen on this issue is actually goes back to drug manufacturing, and that potentially through green chemistry in the long run, pharmaceutical companies will be able to, in essence, turn the drug off once it's outside the body, rather than anticipating that we're going to be able to get full treatment at wastewater treatment plants. But we're years away from that. But it's the piece that I think holds the most promise.
Thank you. That's really interesting, to turn the drug off. All right. And I had a couple of other questions, but I think what I'll do is open it up to committee members if they have any questions. Yes.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Fillmore McPherson from Madison. Picking up on the question that Peggy raised about the discarding of unused, the ones left over, et cetera, it's been my understanding that if your community disposes of its trash through burning one of these, you know, trashed energy stations, that's a very effective way of getting rid of them. And that's, we have the box at the police station and all like that. But I keep telling people who ask me, just put them in the trash, and which gets picked up and burned. You might want to dump them out of the little vial so that someone rummaging through can't say, aha, here's some oxycodone, but am I on the right track there?
So you've actually highlighted both of the components of this. One of the first thing you said, your statement is correct. So one of the ways that pharmaceutical waste is managed is by incineration. However, if you are just putting it in a typical trash receptacle, many of the security issues that are dealt with at the receptacle, at the police station, are created either at the site of the curbside drop-off or at the transfer facility itself. So I guess I could say that at the end point, yes, that's correct. But as a policymaker, I wouldn't call it a complete solution, and I think we really do have a lot more work to do to deal with end-of-life care, because what happens between the household and the incineration facility is just as uncertain as the same thing if you flush down the toilet. Although at the end point, what's happening is much better, but the problem is what's in between. Does that make sense?
I might add to that what the website says is to render it unusable, and there are a number of ways you can do that. For instance, the little brown vial, if you add water in it so you have a soupy mixture, or old coffee grounds or kitty litter, all those things, if you mix it up with that prior to disposing of it, it makes it unusable, so someone rummaging or looking at rubbish would not be able to reuse the product, wouldn't know what the product was, hopefully if it was mushed up enough. So thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative.
Thank you. I appreciate your flexibility with working with our local municipal treatment plants on the phosphorus issue. It seems that we've probably taken a turn where now the federal EPA is more stringent than our state DEP. I mean, but I appreciate your flexibility that way. I was interested in, because some of my towns are under that mandate to upgrade to treat its phosphorus. I was just interested in the funding again. The first three lucked out. It coming under 50%. Now, do the rest of them fall under your traditional 70-30?
Yeah, right now they would still be under 70-30. So I'll just leave it at that.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's great to see you folks again. I had missed the last couple of meetings for a number of reasons, and unfortunately we'll be stepping out again from this one. But I wanted to thank you, Commissioner, for talking about specifically the pesticide issue K-8. As a member of the Environment Committee, you know, we talked about this, and we also talked about the prescription drug take-back issue. But the issue of pesticides through K-8 is a big one in all three of my towns specifically. specifically two of them. And I'm certainly going to be contacting you, looking to do a roundtable with my my leaders in my municipalities. But I'm curious specifically, you're talking about flexibility and regulations. Where is that in process? Have you brought that to the Environment Committee, or how can I help make sure to provide my municipality some flexibility in that? It certainly is an unfunded mandate. We are spending thousands of dollars on fields that we can't use. We're busing children to high schools, which defeat the whole purpose of the pesticide ban. That is the intent. So I'd like to get into a little bit more about that. Thank you.
So just to give you a sense of the process, I've just actually finished my last municipal-only roundtable discussion this morning, which I had to do by phone because I couldn't get the people in the room together. What is a sense of what I've been hearing? What I had planned to do after this is to go before the Environment Committee and probably several of the other committees and synthesize what I had heard from the municipalities quite specifically. And I think you'll have an opportunity, the Environment Committee, to decide what to do with that. I think the most important things I've heard are reflective in some of your comments. One is that the complication in having two or more different ways that you have to manage your turf facilities at the same time is frustrating and expensive. Two, in particular, grub management is very, very challenging. And I actually thought we had put forward something that was going to move last year on that issue, and it ended up not being successful. I think that is clearly a starting point for us this year because we had quite a bit of consensus on that. Number three, your other point, even beyond the complication of having more than one regime, the synthetics-free pesticides management is more expensive. And it is an expense that many towns have decided are worth it. But at the end of the day, when I talk to towns that have been successful with this, there are two main components. One is they do all of their fields the same. Municipal, they do everything no pesticides. So they are good at it at this point. Two, they are willing, they had an initial, there's actually three things, sorry. Two, there's an initial capital cost because you've got to buy some new equipment. That is always the case. Anytime you switch regimes, if someone who tells you it's not going to cost you anything, do not buy whatever bridge they're trying to sell you. Number three, there are actually increased operating costs. So we've seen, and in my interviews with the towns that have been successful and are quite enthusiastic, they say, at the end of the day, I am spending about 20% more, some are higher than that, than I was spending before, but it's worth it because my constituents are demanding this. But this is, honestly, a greater cost. Those are some of the more important things. A few towns also were concerned about invasive species and a few other things. But that's just me reflecting back what I've heard thus far. You'll get a much more complete report from me in the Environment Committee sometime during the session.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes. Go ahead.
You mentioned you had consensus around the grub issue that you'd be starting with this year. What is the consensus?
So my understanding, and you guys are actually in the legislature, so you might be able to tell me more, was that we had a bill, I think, that was put forward by Dr. Silbert, who was originally an environmental advocate, who was one of the supporters of the original ban, the creators of the original ban, that basically acknowledged that there were several compounds that I think he had put on the list in this new bill that would be okay to use if you have a grub issue. So essentially providing specific loophole for if there's a grub infestation. I'm not exactly sure how the bill worked because it didn't pass, so I don't remember exactly what was in there, but I was hoping that the legislature could kind of, since the advocates and the kind of turf folks seem to be on the same page with that, I thought that would be a good place for them to start this year.
You know, I've heard from towns that over the long haul, when they've switched, that they have a much harder time maintaining, especially their fields, because of the use that they get, they don't feel like they can consistently use organic.
So I think it depends on who you talk to. But yes, I have heard that to some extent. One thing that I've actually tried to push the municipalities to talk to me about is, so at the same time as we have this cultural significant increase in intensity of use of the fields, we have made a change in policy. We need to separate those two things. Use intensity and field maintenance is a constant challenge for all fields. The management of fields with organic means can be done in the high-intensity use environment. But, again, it is at a slightly greater expense. You've got to do lots of overseeding. You've got to do aeration. You've got to do grub control. You've got to mow more often. There are a lot of other things that you've got to do in order to do it. But, if you know, in speaking to a town like Greenwich, who does it on all of their fields, their fields look beautiful. That said, Greenwich spends a lot of money. So it's a balancing act, I think, in my mind. I think towns, what I've heard, the most challenged towns in my mind are the ones that have not necessarily had the budget to spend on overseeding and aeration and other things like that. And then in that case, yes, it is difficult to maintain your field if you can't afford to do that because you're not doing the things necessary in order to maintain the field. It'd be like not mowing it or something like that. And so that is really where I wanted to kind of highlight the issue that this is costing folks more, so this is something we need to be aware of.
And I think that will become more and more difficult as we have tighter and tighter, especially at budgets at the municipal levels. Many of our towns are really hurting for those additional funds, and anything that increases their expenses truly makes it much more difficult. Representative Nicastro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, a couple of quick questions. Regarding the noise ordinance, no doubt the local police departments have to respond on that. How do you work in conjunction with them? And, you know, because it's sort of, there's a time delay sometimes. I'm just wondering.
So at a high level, I think it depends on what time the violation occurs. I mean, we, again, the state offices are here from 8 to around 5. And so if you're talking about something that's off hours, then there's automatically going to be a delay. But I'll let Rick and Bob kind of give
sure.
A...
Good afternoon. I'm Bob Girard, the Assistant Director of the Air Enforcement Program. In the state of Connecticut, municipalities are able to adopt a local noise ordinance. There's approximately 70 municipalities that have done so across the state. So if they have a municipal ordinance in place, they're able to go ahead and address the nuisance noise issues in their own town. So for somebody to do that at the local level, they would have to have the ordinance. And then the town chooses who enforces that ordinance. Oftentimes it's a police department, sometimes it's a zoning enforcement officer, et cetera.
Thank you. And Commissioner, also regarding the municipal ordinance on possible review of complaints regarding outdoor furnaces and things like that, how is the state responding on that right now? I mean, as an example, you know we have a large trash-to-energy plant in our city, which has been very, very good for our city and surrounding towns. But I can recall getting complaints going back, you know, regarding odors and things like that coming out of the chimney and smoke going this way and things like that. How are you working in conjunction with them right now?
So this is in regard to the outdoor wood burning?
I'm sorry?
The outdoor wood burning? I want to make sure I understand.
No, in other words, as an example, you know we have a large...
Right, the trash to energy plant.
Right. How do you work in conjunction with that? When somebody complains, do you get the complaint from like the office of the mayor, or you get the complaint from a constituent?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. We have anyone can complain. So honestly, we have multiple points of intake. A constituent, I've gotten personal emails from constituents on issues. At the same time, Mayor Ward has called me to have if he has a challenge, or he's not mayor anymore. Former mayor work. Yes, exactly. I think maybe, Bob, if you want to give some more examples of ways that people can interact with us on that issue.
Certainly. As far as, resource recovery facility goes that you're talking about, as the deputy commissioner stated, anybody is able to complain to our department. Our goal is to get out to citizen complaints within 2 weeks. As the deputy commissioner mentioned, we're based out of Hartford, and it's a big state. And because of that, we primarily try to focus our efforts on things that only we can do and have the skills to do. So we focus our efforts on the more complicated facilities. So, for instance, with the resource recovery facilities, which, knock on wood, we don't get many odor complaints on, we go and investigate those odor complaints. And when necessary, we try to work with the local regulatory officials to identify the sources of the problems. A lot of this, the challenges there have to do with simple logistics. You have to observe the problem when it's occurring in order to identify what the source is and then to order to take regulatory action. So to get somebody there at the right time is very difficult. And that's where having assistance at the local level makes a world of difference to try to bring about, you know, the positive result for the citizen.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I actually have a noise question. Is there standards for the amount of noise that's acceptable, and is there a variance in terms of, like, for the period of time, if it's like 1 second versus 10 minutes versus whatever?
Yes, the noise, state noise regulation looks at the source of the noise and then what type of property is on the receiving end. So if you're a residential property abutted near an industrial source, the noise standards are more stringent than if you're a commercial operation abutted against an industrial source. There are differences in the length of time. There's an impact noise, for instance, which is of a shorter period of time versus something over a length of time. And there's also different standards for certain times of the day. There are certain exemptions for construction activities with certain times of the day and blasting noises, et cetera. So it's really, it's a complicated regulation, and I really have to look at the specific circumstance to determine how it needs to be applied.
And actually, my noise problem you can't fix because it's with the FAA.
Okay. Yeah.
I wish you could. They just suddenly decided that there's not enough noise after they sent people out letters that they were going to abate their noise. And then they suddenly decided, nah, we're not going to do it. So, which was kind of upsetting, as you can well imagine. But I don't think you can fix it for me. I'll have to go other ways. Thank you. Any other additional questions? Yes. Mr. Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess this comment is both to the Commissioner and to you. Has to do with the grubs, or excuse me, the insect grubs. Let's call a grub a grub. And I appreciate your comment that it really is a shadow mandate that you made early on. And so, Madam Chair, I think we should have on our list as we start to wind down our deliberations on this subcommittee or on this committee that that we have that on our list to consider to be one of the things we ask the legislature to adopt to take a more realistic view, I'll call it, toward the grub control. I don't know that this committee should be actually writing the regulation. That's what you legislators are for, but we can at least make the recommendation that the legislature move forward with a more realistic regulation on that front. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And just so you know, we're going to have another presentation on pest management from the municipality's point of view. And so I think that maybe if you wouldn't mind staying till after that in case there are more questions that
I'll try.
Yeah.
I'll be fast.
And I appreciate that. Yeah. I don't expect you to know everything, you know, just at the drop of a hat. But
I also just wanted to mention that the bill from last year on grubs is Senate Bill 917. So folks should take a look at that. It passed the Senate, but did not go further than that. I think it dropped off at 12:01 a.m. or something like that, as it goes.
Those things have been known to happen.
Yeah, so it goes.
So thank you. Are there any additional questions? So thank you very much for your presentation, and I hope you can stay for. And I don't expect you'd have all the answers, but at least it gives us some place to look at going forward what we need to do. So thank you. Our next speaker is going to be on integrated pest management, and it's presented by CCM and Rich Calarco, who's the director of parks and recreation in the town of Hebron, is going to present. Good afternoon.
In front of you, I have...
You know, if you put on the mic when you speak. Yeah, we can hear you sometimes, but they're recording this, so.
Actually, I appreciate you telling me to put the mic on. People do tell me I have a loud voice. We're powering up here, so just give us a quick second. I'd like just to introduce myself at this time. My name is Rich Clarko. I'm Director of Parks and Recreation for the Town of Hebron. But also, so you understand, in regards to my background, I'm a certified sport field manager. What that is there's very few of us in the country. I think we're up to 150 now. A gentleman by Mr. Toma founded an organization called Sport Turf Manager, and Mr. Toma's the one who's done all 48 Super Bowls, and no, I can't get you any tickets to the game because I wouldn't be here if I could. But and this is based on a training and a certification. It's based on education, experience, and a comprehensive testing and background. I'm also an accredited organic lawn provider, and I obviously have my certification in pesticides control. And give a second, and we're ready to roll, I believe. Okay. So, you want me on this side? If it doesn't work, I could talk you through the, you have it in front of you, whatever you, oh, there we go. Okay, that's a little bit of my background, and, you know, obviously I've been in the state for quite a while, as you can see, and I've been involved. I'm also the president of the Connecticut Park Association and the vice president of the New England Sport Turf Association. I don't like to call it IPM. I really feel it's our best management practices. Utilizing IPM is our goal, and one of the things is it does make it difficult. I believe in IPM throughout all my municipal grounds, and it's really a step program. It's not, the object is not to use any type of pesticide, be organic pesticide, which they are, or synthetic. So you break that down to a number of steps. You know, you maintain a history. What is your site's history? What is going on there? So you know. It's a very scientific approach. You know, we identify the problems. We send information to UConn, to UMass, to identify them. You know, we work with our DEP department. You know, what is the problem? Is it a disease? Is it not? I mean, I had one guy send me a picture. It turned out somebody burned... had a bonfire next to his field and melted his grass. You know, so it's more than just one little simple thing. You set thresholds. How many is an acceptable threshold? And again, you're working with the scientist. You know, our thing is very much based on science. I'll be honest with you, I was a little bit put off that we didn't utilize our scientists. We have one of the best turf schools in the country here. I just came back from a national conference, and UConn is considered one of the best turf schools in the country, and we're not utilizing our professors to the level they need. They should have been involved in this legislation. No offense on the person mentioned earlier who presented it, but he's not a turf manager. That's who you need, okay? We check sites. We constantly dig in. I'm on the sites every day in my men. You know, what's the best means other than pesticides, irrigations, you know, all those things, we must determine them. And then we decide what's the best answer. It doesn't mean a pesticide. I'm offended that anyone would use that as their first step. That's unacceptable to me and unacceptable to my profession. You know, these are the types we're faced with. These are the real issues. This is what we see. And it's not only on turf. It's on ornamentals. You know, we have to maintain. We constantly look. Yes, there's a lot of traffic on our fields. But by proper cultural means, you could take care of these issues. You know, and sometimes they do fail. But what have we resorted to? We're using propane, as you can see, in cracks at our schools. That's what we're using to get rid of the weeds. That's a good environmental change. Okay, we're forgetting it's also part of the environment. We are just spending time doing it. And what happens on my ornamentals? I can't even use... There's one correction to the deputy commissioner, and I apologize for the corrections, but he mentioned synthetic pesticides. That's incorrect. We can't use any pesticide that has an EPA number. And I'll show you later, there's some pesticides that are organic that I can't use. Okay? How do we implement? We do it through testing, soils, organic, every means possible. Okay? What has this driven us to? We are now being told we have to put irrigations at our sites. Okay? That's a cost to my town of $75,000 at two fields. I don't know about you, but that's a lot of money for the town of Hebron. Okay? This is the soil web. This is how it really works for a plant. It's the soils that provide the services and all this little information. This is what really makes it happen. These are the things that makes our grass really grow. It's not treating the grass. What do? We take measures, things called like growing degree days. Essentially, growing degree day, if it's 60 and 50, the average for the day is 55. As that goes up during the course of a season, we begin to see, and based on our scientists, we get studies sent to us of what bugs could possibly and what diseases could be happening. It's not a simple little process. It's a whole integrated management system that needs to utilize the scientists and the professional field turf managers. Soil temperature. Certain times as it comes up. Kentucky bluegrass, one of the grasses we grow on sport fields, doesn't really kick in until it gets into the upper 50s. Ryegrass kicks in at 45. There's transitional rye, which I use because it goes later in the year and it can take temperatures to 35 and then it dies off. Okay? Soil temperatures also tell us how we can do things. So it's a very complex process, and yet this law was passed not based on any real science. You know, tissue testing, soil samples. You know, my organization, we run four workshops. I serve on the IPM study committee with DEP and with UConn, and we do workshops. It's important. Overseeding. I hate to tell you how much money I spend currently on seed. I think I should take stock in the seed company, to be honest with you. Okay? Give you an idea, prior to this ban, we were using 3 to 5 pounds per thousand of a square, and that's how we do most of our work for seeding. Currently, recommendations, 30 to 40 pounds per thousand. And at $2 or $4 a pound, you could figure that out. Aeration, little equipment, little cost. Everyone needs aerators. We do it a lot. We do soil testing. We constantly bring that in to improve the soil, cultural means. I'm not going to say everything is wrong. One of the things that's brought many of my people, and I get upset with my turf people in the field, it's brought many of them to at least to come to our education workshops and get better at it. So not everything is painted in a bad thing. It upsets me that these people never came to these trainings before and got educated. Biological controls, one of the things we have to fight grubs right now is this little worm called a nematode. Well, you need 2 billion of these little things to do one football field size, and it needs to be irrigated to do it, or you're doing it in a rainstorm. We came Labor Day weekend when it was raining, and we had to pay overtime because they can't be put out in the sun. Okay? Semi-effective, yes, at a cost of $1,200. and I had him flying in from Netherlands. So, as opposed to the alternate products that are out there for hundreds of dollars. You know, this is our little friend, our little grub. It gives you an idea. We set thresholds. It's not just randomly one and we start going. Our object is not to use very intense products. Our object is to treat products less. Now, two examples. I know it's a discussion to bring a product in. One of the issues I have with what was passed with the law is they were thinking seriously of mentioning the product. The product name is Excelbrin. Excelbrin is the latest product out there to fight grubs. It's so non-toxic. EPA puts four categories, and they measure how you kill rats, okay, basically. And they haven't been able to kill one yet, okay? So it doesn't have a signal word on it. I'm hearing from Syngenta, when I was at this training, they might put that word on. The bill said no product with a signal word. So you could pass this law, and they make a change to ginger by going back to EPA, and then we can't use it. And what are we going to do, come back again for another year of things? Why can't we just use the EPA category system, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and 4 is the least one, and 3, to be able to use products that can be done? You know, it's again, just know. And the product on the right, you're forgetting one thing. What do grubs bring? Molds? They like meat. So it's not just grubs. They love worms. I treated one of my sites so organic, too, that I had a huge grub problem. Fortunately, that wasn't on school grounds, and I was able to get rid of our grubs. Okay? And if you don't get rid of grubs, you bring in their other friend, the skunk. That's what you're seeing on the picture up there, the major damage that happened. You know, here's a product that's in Canada, if you are aware. The province of Ontario is very strict, even stricter than us, on what they have banned. This product is permitted in Canada, Fiesta. Yet, in our state, it has an EPA number. We can't use it. So it's not just grubs. You got to look at safety. Here's two products I'm showing you. One was that Fiesta product, and below it is Avenger. If you can see on the label, it's OMRI, Organic Material Research Institute, approved by my organic groups that I deal with, yet it has an EPA number. I can't use it. Okay? So it's more. All right? Invasives. What are we supposed to do? What you tell me what we're supposed to do. At Hebron, at Gilead Elementary School in Hebron, we got a major attack with some invasives, buttersweet, wiping out our plants. We physically pull them out, they come back in. Okay? Not to mention, you know what's going on in Worcester with the longhorn beetle, and our state very concerned about the M.O. Ashbury, which the commissioner did mention too. Poison ivy. Here's a picture brought in because along a perimeter of field, it's not from my town, a perimeter of a field, there was trees and lines. We're not allowed to spray even on an emergency application for poison ivy because the children shouldn't be along that tree line. Well, the ball went into there. I have children, I assume many of you do or not. Where are they going to go? They're going to go get that ball. So they got poison ivy all over them. I had a situation in one of my schools where I had poison ivy pop up along a playscape. We went in and manually pulled it out. We went in and did every means possible. Finally, our superintendent had to do it, and I had to go in and spray it. I had to spray a huge area. If the law was reasonable, I could have used a little bit of a pesticide and knocked it out right away. That would have saved a lot of problems and the expansion of it. We had it actually blow into a courtyard at our schools, one of our schools that was dedicated to a poor young child who died of cancer. Imagine my embarrassment that I had we go in and get it out. This is an example on the left side of people who sent me pictures of some of their fields and the amount of clover. You know, we're told to accept clover on there. Yes, they attract bees. They're claimed to non-stinging bees. Okay. And crabgrass and things of that nature. They come apart. So, you know, right now the University of Tennessee is doing studies. What happens with injuries? What happens with the other word that's going on in the NFL, concussions, compaction? I take compaction tests on my fields to make sure they don't get heavy and deep. But by you're constantly losing a grass cover, you know, These are reports. I've worked personally with UConn and how we evaluate our fields. So it's not just we're randomly coming out, I need to use pesticide. No way. I don't even like using it. My biggest application of pesticides in the town of Hebron is along one of my cemeteries on a stone walk line so we didn't lose our stone wall. That's my biggest use. You know, we take field reports. You know, we go in, we monitor. I monitor every moment we're out monitoring every system and how much time it takes. Now here, I want to show you a little comparison. You want cost? On one side is my Hebron Elementary School. That's a practice facility, and I'm spending more money on my Primo field, my Dane field, and I can tell you we track in my town, we take care of the two elementaries because we don't do RAM. Okay, so we have to file in with our in-kind report how much money. I've went since this ban from $22,000 to $42,000. So this is not an unfunded mandate. My town manager wants me here to tell you this. Okay, you can see the labor bill. And be honest with you, my supply bill, yeah, there's other means. I had to buy a top dresser, $8,000. Now, the trouble is, we're top dressing with compost. My soil test came back. I'm at the high end of phosphate. So now, what am I supposed to do? Harm the environment? You answer those questions. And at what cost? And other soil amenities. You know, we're told to use these 25B. These are exempt products by EPA. Untested. We're supposed to list the toxicity of them. There's no studies done on these. I'm finally working with UConn, and through DEP's cooperation, we might be able to get a grant to start studying them. You know, but we worked, I served on a committee for almost a year, and we did analysis, and we had all the contingents in this room together, and we were on an agreement that we wanted a super committee formed that would evaluate the use of products. It was a reasonable approach, and the way it would vote worked is, the EP would have reviewed the product. It would have went to the subcommittee. It would have went around the room. Does it make sense for you to use, and I'll use Roundup instead of the chemical name, and you get me fired up about turf, obviously. But is it permitted to use it around fence lines at an elementary school or any school? Super committee would have voted. It had to be a super majority. We went around the room 20-2 to do the vote, okay? We thought everything was done, and because our final vote was 20-2 and wasn't unanimous, it never got moved forward. Okay. However, but my point is, then it went back to DEP for their final review. Let the professionals handle it. Let our scientists. I don't know all the science behind this. We had people from the Department of Health on this committee. They did a study comparing products. This is not my report, and this is stuff the EP can provide to you or I can provide to you, which actually analyzed Roundup versus a different product, and was found Roundup was more effective because you put it down less times. You put it down less times. And that's the issue. They're finding that out in Canada. Why hasn't the ban expanded in Canada? Both British Columbia and all the British are voting it down because it's not effective and they're spending way too much money on other sites. So I always leave a little upbeat. Remember one thing I always say about turf? It grows by the inch, but it's killed by the foot. So, you know, I'm open for any questions, and I thank you for allowing me to preach to you.
Thank you. This has really been very, very interesting, and I think we'll have a number of questions. And at the close, I'm going to ask you for some recommendations, and I'm going to call on Representative Nicastro as a couple of questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I love your passion.
Thank you.
I think you had everybody's interest here of 150%. And, you know, when I hear a person like you speak, it tells me, one, that they love their job and what they're doing. So we rely on people like you. We really do. We're laypersons when it comes to things like this. At least I am. And I can't take a good vote on something unless I hear something from somebody like you that lets me know, makes me understand how important it is. Let me ask you this, a couple of questions. One, how many acres do you have in your city that you have to perform this on?
We mow every week 200 acres. Of which I have 15 athletic fields and two elementary schools within that complex. We manage 1,000 acres of land, and overall. So
okay, and that cost you how much a year doing all of this?
All my fields or the town or just the school fields?
You know, no, it's yours. Say that again.
Did you just want my school fields or just
not everything for the town, for the city?
Hundreds of thousands of dollars off the top of my head. I give you a better report, but we're probably about $350,000. And to give you an answer. And one of the things I didn't tell you, Representative, is that one of the decisions we have to make in our town is if I'm spending that much labor at the school grounds weeding, I have to sometimes make a conscious decision not to weed our downtown business areas as much and as attractive for those sites, which hurts economic development sometimes in our town.
So you've given me some figures. As an example, I represent Bristol, where we have
much more than us.
Much more, a lot more. I'm thinking just Muzzy Field alone.
Correct.
Okay, which all the schools use, and everybody else, for that matter, major parks, and it's costing you that kind of money. So I have to multiply that and think in my head, that's what's happening in Bristol, but on a larger scale.
Correct.
And there's cities bigger than Bristol. You know, when this bill was passed about having the schools sprayed and grass like that, did you testify at that meeting?
Yes, I did.
You did?
Yes. I testified. There was a delay of the bill of 1 year. I've testified a number of times. My concern is not only, I appreciate you and for listening and thinking my knowledge, but more importantly, there's people at UConn, like Dr. Henderson and others out there that really are, you know, the scientists behind it, our entomologists in the state, and those are the people that even have way more and understand the chemical knowledge much more. And UConn's doing tremendous research there, as well as other places around the Northeast.
If you could wave a magic wand, what would you suggest as a bill for us to come out with to make it easier, less costlier, but not endangering children?
Best management practices, using IPM and really working, again, to establish that committee that we talked to, that I mentioned earlier, to really monitor people. I'm concerned that there's people out there doing things that they shouldn't be doing.
Shouldn't be doing, you say?
Yeah, and I'm just talking from cultural things. You know, some people are abandoning fields. Some of it's, I know follow people that work the field that says, oh, what the heck, I can't do anything. I'm lucky I'm going to take care of my fields, So, the education has been helpful. But I really believe a best management practice utilizing IPM, because quite frankly, in my organic practices as well, you do need to use, means of IPM to identify it. And even in our IPM standard, one of our standards is sometimes we have to take extraordinary measures. It's the last resort. I really believe in that. I hate using pesticides, anyone. But you need to know these 25B that we are permitted to use, as I mentioned, aren't tested. They have to get a license in our state, and those are classified by our Department of DEP and EPA as a pesticide. They're just not as toxic. They're made up of products. And one of our concerns right now, we're allowed to use a product called CedarCure, and there could be some carcinogenics, we believe, possible. We don't have the science on that, and we're hoping that research will help us.
If I could get you to come in to speak to somebody on this, would you be willing to do that?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. It sounds a little bit like what so often happens when we see a problem out there. The pendulum swings, and we go from so extremely stringent that it doesn't work right, and somewhere around some time forward, we have to get it back into the middle where we have better common sense. And it sounds like we sort of missed the boat somewhat, and there needs to be more practical, look at it in a more practical manner. Betsy Guerra has some questions.
Hi, thanks, and I apologize, I was called away. In a lot of the smaller communities, you have a limited number of playing fields. You have your municipal playing fields, and you have a lot of the youth teams playing on those. You also have a lot of your, school fields, and sometimes the kids are playing on those. Sometimes they're playing on the municipal fields. Does that create some confusion with the way that the law is currently crafted?
I have been running classes. As a matter of fact, we had a meeting the other day with DEP representatives, and it's amazing when we run a workshop how all the municipal people and school people ask us questions, even though this law has been in tax intent too. So the answer is, and the short answer is yes, it's very confusing. Absolutely.
So would your proposal or recommendations then address that confusion?
Yes. I'm a strong believer that it should be the entire municipal operation should be all one thing. And I would even go to that route. Right now we are not forced to use IPM in municipal. I think we should. And one thing just to note, I mean, to me, we're looking to put little Band-Aids on this law. You know, if I have a major cut, you know, I'd rather get stitches than Band-Aids. And I think that's what we're attempting to do here. We're starting to run out and say, oh, you know, we got a grub problem. And then we'll come back a year later, but what about the molds? Or now we got M.O. Ashbourne, or now we have this. I mean, I think we need to sit back and address everything and make one comprehensive correction, which, you know, as a town, are we supposed to run out and start buying all this equipment because this is the current law?
And I have to say, I don't know about other towns, but in my town, you know, the budget's getting tighter and tighter, and so we have less ability to go out and purchase all this new equipment. And it sounds like even if we did, we're not doing the best we can for our fields that we could with better management. We could actually do a better job. And one of the things I'm hearing, and I'm not really up on a lot of this, that the EPA number means many different things, and it's not necessarily something that we would look for as a product we don't want to use. Is that correct?
The way it works right now, if I could answer your question, anything with an EPA number, we are banned from using, okay? It doesn't matter if it's organic, non-organic, it's everything, okay? And I challenge you to go to one of your stores and pull up one of their products and find products that don't have an EPA number. I don't think that was the true intent of the law, but that's the reality of the law, that we can't use these products. Horticultural oils, made of natural products, neem, which I would use on some of my ornamental shrubberies, I cannot use because it has that EPA number.
So what does that EPA number actually mean?
The EPA number is a number these companies get they register their products with the federal level. And then they get these numbers. And they have to meet certain criteria. And I'm not, you know, the DEP, I know the Pesticide Union, and particularly Brian Robbins, can answer that more intensely than I can. That's not my expertise. But my understanding is once they get these numbers, we're out and we can't use them. And it's based on their, you know, reason for registering. They do get signal words, categories 1, 2, and 3, which represents, you know, danger, caution, or just warning on the products. So once they establish, they get these numbers, we no longer can use them on K-8 schools.
Of course, when I think organic, I think of farmers using animal droppings as part of their fertilizer, and then I think about black flies and other things that come as a result of that. So to me, that's not always the best answer.
Correct.
In terms of helping things grow properly. Anybody else have any other questions? Yes.
You asked the same questions I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. But I do have, maybe the Deputy Commissioner can address what these EPA numbers are, because that's where I am confused. Because what I've heard is organic, 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 and what he's saying is that with whether it's organic or not, if it has an EPA number, then it's not allowed.
There's a lot of mics available. So Richard, first of all, I've met with Richard several times on this issue, and I actually agree with many of the things that he said. So I'm thankful for his passion and knowledge on this issue, because it's actually been very helpful in terms of shaping some of the things you heard me say earlier. In terms of the EPA numbers, I can't answer the question directly. He's right. Brad Robinson is the absolute right person to answer the question. I think what I can do is get an answer for you guys and exactly what they mean. I think they mean different things depending on the product. Perhaps not surprisingly, the federal government does not have the most easy-to-understand way of managing the space. So, but we'll get an answer for you guys and share it with the committee so that you can have it in written form.
So, Deputy Commissioner, what would you suggest would be a recommendation or a potential recommendation to change the law
so,
to provide the materials that are needed to make sure that our turfs are taken care of at a reasonable price, as far as maybe adjusting the EPA guidelines or from the state? Some kind of a balance.
So I think that's one area, although we didn't talk very much about that in the municipal meetings. The things that I heard most, and I mentioned some of them earlier, the only reason I'm being a little bit shy about this is that I haven't had my final meeting with all the municipalities yet, which is going to be next week, where I tell them this is what I heard, and I don't want to get out in front of all those things. But what I can do is at least reflect what I did hear, and then we'll come back with a more final response. But the grubs issue is one that I heard many, many times. Another one that was actually mentioned several times by Richard, the difference here between the spirit of this law and how it actually gets implemented is important. And so when you have this law applying to something like ornamentals, so whether you're talking about things that are growing in fences or even weeds in the sidewalk, you think about what the law is for. It's really to manage large, long exposure. How often do kids run and play soccer on the sidewalk over the one weed that happens to be growing in the middle? And one of the things that we noticed in the New York law, which actually was patterned on our law, New York just passed a statewide ban, similar to ours, with several changes like the ones that we are talking about. For example, it does not apply to ornamentals. There are loopholes for invasive species and grubs. The other things that I have heard from the municipalities that I thought were very interesting was the concept of group buying. So this thing that would decrease cost for municipalities, the fact that it's so hard to get nematodes sometimes, depending on when you get them. If we're a whole state that's buying the same stuff, why on earth are the municipalities forced in the situation of having to procure them on their own? There's got to be a way that we can help them with that. Additionally, there are very few people who know as much about this as Richard. Not every town has that person, and so many of the towns, I talked to one mayor who said, I was sitting on my laptop Googling things for 4 hours trying to figure out what I was supposed to buy. That's not a good use of the mayor's time, so could we provide someplace a best practices manual that's easy access for the towns? Things like that, I agree with Richard in the sense that what we'd like to try to come forward with, and this is state and municipalities and advocates hopefully together, is with a single set of changes that will hopefully fix everything and make it possible to make all of the fields managed in the same way. That's my goal. You never know what happens at the end of the day, as you know, but I think that would hopefully resolve many of the challenges that people have.
Part of this committee's mandate is to look at if we could do, through regionalization, make savings for our communities that we serve. So the idea of bulk buying might be really something very important for us to look at. A manual for best practices might be another thing, because especially small communities don't have the resources that maybe a large city might have. And even they don't always have the resources they need to do best practices. And so often we know, I work in the healthcare, so we look at standards all the time. And there are national standards, and we look at those. So that's where I come from. And so I think it's important that we do look at that. So thank you. That's probably an excellent suggestion. Representative Nacosta.
Thank you. Commissioner, is your intent or your department's intent to submit changes this coming session? I know it's a short session.
So we won't be, it's not going to be our bill. My hope is that if I can get the legislative chairs together on board with a bill, that one of the committees will have a bill that we can work on together, but it won't be an executive branch bill. We'll support it. But in my mind, my role here has been to try to synthesize both the scientific community and the voice of the municipalities and play that back to the legislature in a way that they can't help but hear.
The reason why I ask that is because Madam Chair and I and the rest of us, you know, if we can be of help and this would be beneficial to our cities and towns and the safety of children, most importantly, you know, let's do it. Every day that we waste that goes by is another cost and things like that. The safety of the children is most important. But I think if we can work here together, this is a mandate that could possibly save our cities countless thousands and thousands of dollars. That's the whole purpose of this. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Yes.
Rich, I know that there are maybe anecdotally, you can tell us a little bit about some of the Board of Ed fields are unplayable across the state. And so a lot of that resource is gone, and students are being brought to the municipal fields. How much of that is happening? I mean, we're losing that resource, and yet we still own that resource.
I don't have exact numbers right now. I'm working right now with we sent a survey out that I'm working through UConn, and we're taking those reports right now. It is getting up there. The number. What we're seeing is a lot, and particularly in the elementary schools, they pretty much have made those fields basically practice just green areas for playgrounds and stuff like that, and have taken them off market. I'm familiar with some towns that have lost that ability and have built fields away from school grounds. I can't give you an exact number on that. One thing I do want to point, you mentioned best management practices. Well, that's already been done by Dr. Henderson. It's on the UConn website. Best management practices utilizing a non-pesticide approach. So, again, I think it's important to communicate through our schools and stuff like that. And we have done workshops, several of them around the state. And I have Dr. Henderson scheduled to do a presentation with our association, Connecticut Park Association, and CRPA, and I believe we're scheduled April 9th, and we're working on the date now. And our whole approach that day is, again, an education program to teach people how to do it. We recently had another one we're going to do in August, and that one's going to be in, we're hoping, Newtown. But our goal would be is to show people how physically to do some of the seeding process and things. So we are working on education and training to people.
Thank you. Deputy Commissioner.
Just want to add, and Rob just showed, we've been updating our webpage as well with some information. I think what I heard from the mayors is really UConn or us, they don't know where to go yet. So unless you know Dr. Henderson, and we've contracted him too. We're actually working with him at the same time. But they don't know to go there. And so I think it's not that the information doesn't exist. It's more that it's not in a place where they can find it. But we've got it on our webpage as well. We've got a whole page on the pesticide ban and how to take care of grounds at the daycare centers and schools. But that said, if you're a mayor of a small community and you don't have someone who knows as much as Richard, then all you know is to use Google. And Google may not find one of these pages. We don't seed our pages on Google because it's expensive. So I think that's really the challenge.
Mr. McPherson?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Clerco, that was an excellent presentation. Thank you very much. I want to make sure that I got some of your thoughts correctly. Thought number one was that our very own UConn is one of the country's foremost experts in this field, and I've heard that from several sources, including I think from a commissioner at one of the roundtables a month or so ago. So I think that is true. And then I think you also said, and I've heard this before also, that the legislation that we are discussing today was drafted without any real input from one of the experts in this country that's, what, 50 miles away from Hartford. Madam Chair, I find that surprising.
Not sure that's totally true, but I think maybe not as much input as folks would like. I think.
Yeah. Thank you. So anyway, that's one of my takeaways here, and I would suggest going back to an earlier comment about what this commission, what this committee can do. This commission, we're not the drafters, but I think we should certainly urge, when it comes down to our decision points, the reconsideration of Senate Bill 917. I'm not sure how that works legislatively. I'll let you professionals figure that out. But also that we consider adopting some of these more common sense proposals from the New York law as they move forward, and then also potentially taking a look at the, whether it's the EPA numbers or something that would allow a little bit of flexibility in deciding which products can be used. I think we have some great opportunities here, and I think the legislature has some great opportunities. Thank you.
Yeah, I think so. I think that some of what we heard today would be very easy for us to do, and probably there's a practical side of it that it would be very important, and it would be a cost savings and a benefit to our community. So we'll probably be asking more questions of you going forward as we prepare, because it's going to be one large bill for the more towards the end. So I think, some of what we've heard today really is important that we do go forward and do more with this. So thank you very much. Thank you both for your presentation. It's certainly been informative. I want to thank members of the committee. I think that today's really been interesting. I think going forward, this is something we want to add more to. Does anybody else have anything they need to add? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to know what we're going to cover in the next meeting. Are we going to look at any other mandates that have been brought before us to have any testifying for, or any of the issues? That's what I'd like to know.
I'm not sure. Did we have an agenda, David? I don't think we did.
We don't have an agenda as of yet. We will, if the chair is available, we can discuss that today, and I will get that out to committee members ASAP.
Well, do we have a date?
We do not have a date yet.
Okay.
Well, who's determining what the next topics are?
If you want to send either, I think you have David's email. Send him an email on whatever topics you want, or do you want to mention them? We'll put them in the minutes, or however you want to do that. I'll be happy to hear from you.
Okay.
Yes.
Just a broader question in terms of timeline. I know we'll pick a date for the next meeting, but we mentioned that we're wrapping things up. Some committees have drafting subcommittees from the subcommittee. I don't know if this is something that group is interested in, but I guess my question is, how are we going to corral what we've talked about and prioritize those?
And that's probably a good question, which I might not fully have an answer for you. Because we'll be using some staff members to kind of come up with some, and that might be part of what we'd have on the agenda at our next meeting, sort of a list of issues, sort of what we want to do with them, and what drafting would look like. Yes?
I just have one question in terms of notice for the next meeting, just so that we could continue to have a little bit of advance notice. And I've appreciated that by this committee.
Okay. And it will probably be on a Friday. And I would say probably if we sort of think about in terms of 2 weeks from today, that will give us still time to get our hands around what we want to do in terms of legislation and to get it completed in time. So, yes.
Yes. One issue that we might want to include at our next meeting is the repeal of the insurance premium tax on municipal health care policies. The reason I was called away was that the governor just had a press conference where he announced that he was going to recommend as part of his budget that that be eliminated. So that would be something that would be very helpful, and it would be helpful if this group could also lend its support to that initiative. It is something that we included in our list of mandates that impose burdens on municipalities, and I know it's part of CCM's agenda as well.
So we already have that information.
It was included in our list. I think it was included in their list. But I mean, just to talk about it, whether we make a formal recommendation to support that, given that it seems to be gaining some momentum this session.
Would then maybe we could do a little bit of more information on it for our next meeting? Although I want to kind of make some of our next meeting conclusions rather than opening, but it sounds like that might be something that we want to address going forward.
I think that could go fairly quickly, Madam Chairman, so we probably should add that.
Yes.
You know, that's not going to be a long discussion.
Yeah. All right. Any additional? If not,
motion to adjourn.
Moved and seconded. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.